Thank you.
Yeah. It's very nice to be back. UCLA is one of my favorite campuses, and especially IPAM, which having witnessed its birth through the hard labor of Mark and others, it's really a flourishing place. It's very good to be back here. Thank you for inviting me. So what I want to do today is to report to you some of our effort in trying to implement an approach to study gene regulation. And I feel that this is an approach that can be applied in many biological processes, and I'm going to use the study of embryonic stem cell as an example. This is very much work in progress, and so a lot of the method has not been refined, and the results are very preliminary. But what I hope to give you is an idea of the general approach, the kind of data that you'll be dealing with, and some of the issues that can be addressed using this approach. So in for the past few years, we've been very interested in looking at the early differentiation in mammalian development. So we look at an in vitro system where we can grow up embryonic stem cells, and then through the withdrawal of an important factor, the LIF factor, these cells can be made to spontaneously differentiate. And so if you put these cells in gelatin, they would start to come together. After a few weeks' time, they form this aggregate of cells called embryoid bodies, EB. And so the period is, you know, roughly 3 to 5 weeks. And during this various time, we take samples, and then we do microarray expression profiling using some affymetric microarrays. So typically, we take multiple biological replicates. So some of the questions that we want to answer, and this is typical for any, you know, differentiation process, is what are the, you know, major gene expression patterns that are showing up among the genes, and how are they regulated, and we try to relate this transcriptional program to the questions of self-renewal, pluripotency, and some of the early lineage decisions. And the molecular technique that we're using to assay these cells include microarray profiling, cell sorting, chip-chip chromatin immunoprecipitation of microarray. And of course, after all the data is generated, it's important to do the right kind of computational analysis. That's where statistics comes in. So in this time course that I showed you, you can look at genes that are showing that are not expressed in stem cells, and then later on become upregulated. That's actually the more important cell genes. But first, let me comment on the genes. And the more important cell genes are the genes that are very high in embryonic stem cell and then not expressed in the differentiated cell. So we are actually more interested in that set. But let's first look at this set that are upregulated during the time course. So if you do a minimal selection, you know, just taking up genes that are showing some variation during the time course. So if you look at the standard deviation of the expression along the time course, and make sure that it is at least a reasonable percentage of the average expression over that same period of time. Then, of course, you're interested in the upregulated genes. So you want the later time point average to be higher than the early time point average. So the 2 week to 5 week average is higher than the undifferentiated to 4 day average. So you get about 900 genes this way. Let's see, I'm missing some. Okay. Well, anyway, so let me not try to search for that. If you look at the expression pattern of these 900 genes, all you can see is that, you know, they are low in the beginning and high later, right? That's the broad pattern, because we have only a few time points. And even if we sample more time points, you are not going to see many, many variations, because these are very broad developmental programs. So in order to get more biological meaning out of this data, we decided to include, together with this developmental time course, which are given here, so we have 35 profiles here, we included some embryonic endoderm cells at about 13 days in the embryonic development, and then some in vivo micro-dissected tissues from the CNS development, and then some embryonic fibroblasts, and then some published data, previously published data on the mesodermal lineage. So altogether, we have about 80 profiles. And then we want to look at how many different types of expression patterns are there in this program. And basically, if you analyze this using cluster analysis, you know, these are the main kind of patterns that you get. So there are genes that are expressed very high in the undifferentiated stage and then silenced later, but that group is not looked at in this study here. And then there are other groups of genes. For example, this group is expressed highly only, you know, during this type of embryonic endoderm cells and not the other type. And then there are these that are expressed in the this is expressing embryonic liver, has a particular type of endoderm cells, and these are expressing heart, and so on. So roughly there are about 25 to 30 distinct patterns that you can look at, and we use a process called tight clustering. So Jun in his morning talk has already referred to this algorithm. What it is basically a refinement of the usual clustering algorithm to clean up each cluster so that you throw away some of the genes that seems to be not truly relevant to that cluster. So the result of this clustering analysis is to refine the 900 genes to only about 350, and then this 350 is further subdivided into a different cluster that we've seen there. So the first thing you can do with this kind of cluster is to ask the question, can you find any sequence motif in the nearby regulatory regions that may account for the expression that you're seeing? And sometimes you can discover some patterns. So for example, in the cluster that is high in embryonic endoderm and liver, you know, you can see this is a highly represented cluster. A motif in this cluster. And if you look at the sequence conservation, often you'll find that, so that motif I showing you is this motif 3 here. And you often find that they are highly conserved among multiple vertebrate species. So in this case, it's conserved up to chicken, but not to fish. Right? So when you see conservation up to, you know, chicken, it's a pretty good indication. And also, if you see that this motif is recurring in a small region, so this few hundred base pair contain two occurrences of this motif, it's also a good indication. So you can look at this kind of picture and get some idea of, you know, whether this motif and this site is possibly relevant. However, we were not too successful with many other of the clusters. And so Howdy just told me that they have better success in their data set, so I really want to find out whether it's the information in their data that is more relevant, or whether we're missing some part of the important consideration in the computation. But in any case, in our hands, we were not too successful with some other clusters, and we think that part of the reason is that binding motif in mammalian species are short and not very specific. So this coupled with the fact that you have to search in a very large region, because the regulatory elements can be very far away from the transcription start site of the gene, then what you end up with is lots of false positives. And so the data, it seems to us, is not really powerful enough to give you what you want reliably. So this consideration motivated us to try to incorporate other type of biological information to enrich our signal to noise. Now in embryonic development, so let me now move back to the set of genes that are highly expressed in the undifferentiated cells but are silenced in later development. And there are quite a large number of such genes. And for that set of genes, we have more knowledge because we know that there are a few key transcription factors that are very important in regulating these genes. For example, the transcription factor OCT4 has been shown to be absolutely required to maintain the embryonic stem cell state. And fortunately, this transcription factor has been studied experimentally, and there is a known weight matrix for its binding site. And so the consensus is here, and there's a weight matrix. So one thing we can do is to try to make use of this weight matrix. So we start with about 200 genes with a expression level that is very characteristically high in the early EB and the ES state, and then basically not expressed in the differentiated cell type. And in the pre-implantation state, it's not very high. And so what we did is we tried to look at a reasonably large region among the transcription start sites of each of these genes. And then we use a process called anchor alignment to extract subregions from these larger regions. So basically, we scan those regions by the weight matrix and try to find locations which give a high score according to the weight matrix. So we did this for human and for mouse. Now, because the weight matrix is not that strong, you're going to get many, many hits. And so we know that most of those hits are not really real. So we want to look at the sequence alignment in order to screen out the false positives. So what we did is for each possible pair of such a hit, we try to extend the sequence. So we require the site to be aligned, right? And we try to extend the alignment both sides using basically a dynamic programming type alignment. And we try to pick up the pairs that has a good score in this kind of alignment. So this is called anchor alignment because they are anchor among the site that are hits in the weight matrix. And so with this process, we have a few interesting findings. So this is, in this case, in the nanlot genes, so this particular OCT4 site is significant in the anchor alignment. And so we can look at the regions surrounding the sites extracted by anchor alignment, because anchor alignment actually gives you the region. And then we can apply just ordinary motif discovery in the extracted sequence to see if there's any new motif. So in this case, it actually provides another motif to us, which on closer examination turned out to be very similar to the SOX factor motif. So it is by now known that SOX2 seems to be actually cooperating with OCT4 in this regulation. So this is encouraging that this kind of analysis can actually give you reliable results. So in this case, the SOX2 site is actually right next to the OCT4 site in the Langnaud regulatory region. For lefty, which is another very highly expressed signaling molecule in the stem cells, they are separated by a very short distance. Right, so using this kind of prediction, we have predicted quite a number of what we feel are possible enhancer elements. And so the postdoc who are working on this project at Doug Melton's lab in Harvard, so this is a collaboration with Doug's lab, has designed a assay to verify, to confirm some of these predictions. So this is a validation. And basically what you do is you take the 5'5 luciferase gene as a reporter, hook it up to a minimal promoter from the SV40. So just this promoter alone doesn't give you a lot of activity. But if you have a good enhancer, such as the SV40 enhancer itself, it will give you a very high expression. So we have two different luciferase genes. One is hooked up to the SV40 enhancer, so this should give a high signal, right? And the other luciferase gene is hooked up downstream from the gene to a predicted, experimentally predicted enhancer. So if this enhancer really is working, then you should have some activity, and you would want to normalize this activity to the vanilla luciferase, just to adjust away any systematic bias due to transfection inefficiency and so on. But so after you normalize, what you really want to compare is the signal you get with the enhancer, predicted enhancer here, and without this enhancer, just based on minimal promoter. So using this assay, we have tested a number of predictions. And you can see that most of with just the promoter alone, is the signal is at 1, right? So if the ratio is 1. And you can see that most of the predictions do have larger than 1. And this is based on many replications. So you can see the standard error bars there. And so most of these are just significantly upregulated. But it's somewhat disappointing to see that only a few of them are very high fold change. Most of the fold change are sort of 2, and some are 3 and 4-ish. So this is somewhat of a letdown to me, at least personally. But I think on the whole, if you look at it statistically, they are upregulations. So part of the problem may be that the experimental and predicted enhancer may not work well with the minimal promoter of the SV40. But if we get the lady promoter here, maybe we can do better. But that's a lot more work than this system. No, so this is just exactly the sequence element that we extracted from mouse. So it's the whole element. So this is typically 200 base pair, yeah, including the
surrounding.
So we analyzed the site just to assess the element itself. Yeah. And so we didn't do site mutations and so on to where the site.
Did you do some just random 200 base pairs and other?
Yeah, so let me show you the other experiment. So the previous experiments are, so this is done in ES cells, undifferentiated cells. If you repeat this experiment, but in a different cell type, so in this time is a mouse fibroblast cell, and then you can now see that most of the signals are, the things is around 1, and most of them are actually below 1. So you see statistically it is significant, it's just that the fold change is somewhat disappointing. So I think that still on the whole, I think the prediction is getting the right kind of element.
So different motifs are predictive?
No, it's the same.
No, but these are predicted motifs from the
computation. Yeah.
Is that just similar motif representing
the
different promoter
given
gene?
No, you're just testing it in a different cell type. But the prediction says that in embryonic stem cell, you have the right kind of transcription factor to activate that element.
I see. So it's just one version.
Right. It's the same element that we are testing, but in different cell type. And as expected, you're not seeing activity in this undifferent. Yeah.
Is the correlation between this observed fold change and the original native stage of the fold change? What is the correlation there?
There are some correlation, but I mean the high one that we are seeing are very highly expressed. But some of the low thing that low fold change here also have high fold change in the actual data, so I mean the correlation is not perfect, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the name here? That's the gene with that 200 base pair.
Yeah. Those are the genes. So I think in this first series of study, basically we have added quite a number of predicted gene regulatory elements to the knowledge base compared to what we were able to find in the literature. So it is reasonably substantial new addition of knowledge. But on the whole, I think that this kind of approach by itself probably is not sufficient to really build a detailed picture of the regulatory program. So for this reason, we are now looking at several new assays in order to generate supplementary information. So I want to take the remaining time to go through some of these newer experiments. So this is very recent kind of experiment. So this postdoc in Doug Melton's lab has now been generating fact-sorted data. So for example, for OCT4 itself, in the late 90s, a Germany-based group has do a lot of study to map the Abibus enhancer of this gene. So we have a sequence, about 300 base pair that is known to drive the OCT4 expression in this mouse cells. So we use it to drive the GFP, and so if the cells are expressing GFP, that means probably means the OCT4 gene is expressed. So we sort the ES cells according to whether they're expressing this GFP or not, and the GFP signal can be used for the fluorescent activated cell sorter to separate the cells into these two subpopulations. So in this population, you expect a different gene expression pattern than this other population. So you again do the time course, right? At undifferentiated state, 2 day, 4 day, 8 day, you can do this kind of experiment. In each time, you sort this into two fractions. So now we have two samples at each time, and there are some biological replicates. Now the first step is to make sure that the reporter is actually tracking the native OCT4 expression. So if you compare the microarray measured OCT4 expression, you can see that it's sort of going down as the embryo body develop, and the percentage of GFP positive cells also is tracking this pattern. So we know that this Abibus enhancer is really driving the right kind of expression. Now this is the picture that convinced me that this experiment is very informative, because if you look at just the set of genes that are showing some variation among these 16 samples. So the standard deviation over mean is at least 0.8, right? And that it has a reasonably high expression in at least 4 of the 16 samples. So it's a very minimal kind of selection. You selected these genes and you just do a standard clustering. You can see that it immediately sort into two groups. And these groups are the GFP positive, and these groups are the GFP negative cells. In fact, there was some mislabel in the original experiment. So some of these are labeled as negative, but then we did this and immediately seen that those labels are wrong. But there's no particular reason why this has to happen, right? Because this selection doesn't use the expression all that much. It just uses the variation, doesn't use the classes. So the fact that it's sorted into these two populations in such a strong way, so that the status of OCT4 is really a big driving factor of the expression. So you can explain a lot by looking at this subpopulation. And these are some of the, I can skip over this time being. When we look at the full change in the two positive and negative samples, you can see that huge number of genes are actually showing very high fold change. I mean, normally in two sample study, you don't see things like bigger than 10 fold change, but you now have hundreds of this kind of large fold change, in both in the positive and the negative direction. Positive direction means that it's upregulated during development. negative is the opposite. Okay, so with this kind of more purified cell samples, we feel that the microarray information is strengthened. It's more signal to noise is higher in that data. But we feel that that is still probably not enough because the regulatory region is still very big. So you still have to search over this 20K to 50K region to find those binding sites. And so fortunately, recent development has shown us how to narrow down that search region. And the idea is really very lateral. In the cell, you can imagine that there are different types of transcription factor that bind to the DNA. And let's say you're interested in a particular transcription factor, let's say OCT4 itself, right? So this is OCT4. It binds to some fragments in the chromosome. And what you do is you use formaldehyde to cross-link them, and then you sonic K to fragment this into fragments of 500 to 1,000 base pair in length. If you have an antibody that specifically recognizes this transcription factor, you can use the antibody to extract only those fragments that are bound by this factor. And then you extract it, you hybridize it to a microarray. This microarray is called a tiling array. Basically, you put a probe every few hundred base pair along a genomic region that you want to study. Then, if this fragment is extracted, then the probe that hybridized to this particular fragment will show higher hybridization signal when you do the microarray experiment. So in this way, you can get approximate localization of the bindings of this particular transcription factor. So we've been doing quite a few of these experiments in our lab. One of the things that our group did after moving from Harvard to Stanford in 2004 is to set up the lab to just do this kind of experiment. We don't do microarray expression, just chip. That's what we want to do. And so Hong Yang, a postdoc in the lab, has been using some Affymetrix array. And this is a sort of a preliminary experiment where we take the antibody that target Pol2 itself. Pol2 is the polymerase, the basal transcriptional machinery. And so this is typical of what you see. So there is the sample that you want to study that gives the red signal, and there's a control sample. And you can see that in this region, the red is much higher than the green. And this is the full change, and this is after processing using an HMM model to map the binding region. So you see, this is actually in the landlord gene. The landlord starts around here. This is where the promoter sits. And this is a different gene downstream from landlord. And so these two genes are both expressed clearly. And what is a little bit surprising is the extent that Pol2 binding is showing up. I'll come back to that later. This is a different gene, NODO, also a highly expressed gene in embryonic stem cells. So in the embryonic stem cell type, you again see this kind of situation. Multiple binding regions for Pol2. If you go to a gene that is not expressed in stem cells, so the Itono gene is later active in neural development, but it's not supposed to be expressed in stem cell. And this is where its promoter sits. So you do see a little bit of binding for Pol2. But it's not extending into the gene. So it's very interesting. The antibody that we're using here actually target the part of the Pol2 machinery that move along. So that for very highly expressed genes, you will see that because there are many, many Pol2, moving along, so you actually, the signal extend into the gene, the coding regions. And so actually this is a way to sort of get an approximate idea of the expression level of the gene. But sometimes the Pol2 can bind to the promoter. There's a little bit, but it's just not doing anything. It's not transcribing. So that's sort of interesting. If we target landlord rather than Pol2, again, looking at atonal, this is not expressed in ES cells, so you don't actually see any signal. But the Lennox binding is showing up in a different gene. So this is UTF1, which is a highly expressed gene. So we've done enough of this experiment to sort of convince ourselves that this is a technology that probably is giving us a good result. And the background signal is actually quite respectable. But respectable is low. So this affymetric technology seems okay. We've also been playing around with the Agilent technology. So this is a joint project with Andy McMahon at Harvard, in which we take the Agilent away and we tile a number of genes that are important for Sonic Hedgehog mediated transcriptional program. So of course, for Sonic Hedgehog, the G proteins are the right transcription factor to target. So this is a artificial G protein that we make with a flat tag that we add to the protein. And so using that as the immunoprecipitation bridge, we did a number of studies. So this is a on the patch 1 gene, which is known to be regulated by G1. So this particular site here, very high signal, is a long binding site for G in the patch 1 enhancer. So this we regard as a positive control. So we are always interested in looking at this region. But when we actually look at the result, we are surprised to see that around this site, there are multiple G binding sites that are almost as good as this one. So even the Sonic Hedgehog expert like Andy McMahon was very surprised to see. So this kind of experiment can give new information, even for some non-enhancers. So you can see that the contrast between the Agilent technology and the affymetric, I think, is that the Agilent has more background as compared to affymetric, but the fold change are much more dramatic. So you get more linear fold change as compared to the native fold change. But for localization purpose, probably both will work. This is a less dense tiling array, so this is the scale is 10 to the 7, right? The PVS scale is 10 to the 4. So the affymetric is much denser, give you better localization. But if you just want to know roughly where the enhancer is, this is okay. All right, so this is now a very recent development because we have planned to do, OCT4, SOX2, Lennox, and so on in our ES cell system. And Hong was just set up to do this. And then we see this paper published by Rick Young in Cell a few months in late September, I think. So at first we were quite shocked by that because, our experiment has been done is not only in mouse but in human. But on further examination, it seems it's not that bad because what they have done is the following. They have prepared a tiling array tiling about 10,000 base pair near the transcription start for this many genes, so a lot of genes. They use Agilent 60-mer array. Every 300 to 400 base pair, they put a probe down. And so this is a very valuable data, and they did it not only for one transcription factor, but for three. So it's a lot of data. But they have not really analyzed it in a lot of detail. I think they probably must be under some pressure to publish it. So basically, they released all their data, put it on the web. Very generous of them. And then they did some statistical analysis on how many genes has binding signal from all three vectors and so on. And so they have done enough to convince us that the data is informed, is good. But not quite enough to really get down to the binding site level. So we feel that this is a chance for us to actually enrich our data so that we don't have to do the experiment that urgently now. Eventually we'll have to do that using a denser array. But now we can take their data and combine with our expression data and see what kind of story we can build. So this is very much in process now, and I want to sort of review with you some very preliminary finding just coming out now from this exercise. So we've been looking at several sets of genes, and these genes are selected based on the binding signal that Rick Young's lab provide and also our own expression data. So for example, if we look at this picture here, so So this green circle with this number of genes, a little bit more than 1,000 genes, they are the genes that show negative fold change. That means they are low in embryonic stem cell and high in later development. And this set of red genes are the ones that have the opposite expression pattern. They're high in stem cell and low in differentiated cells. And this is based on our all four sorted series of data. And this middle cell of gene, the blue genes, are the ones that has binding signal from Rick Young's data. All right, so now you can ask the question, if you have this many blue genes and this many green genes and they are randomly selected from this set of possible genes, how many overlap do you expect? So you can do that simple calculation, and you know the p-value is not, you know, not very exciting, but this number here is much more exciting. So you can do a quick screening to see whether that transcription factor seems to have more of an effect as an activator. So this probably indicates that SOX2's effect is more like an activator than a repressor. I mean, it doesn't rule out that it still has repression. Repressor activity, but statistically it's not that dramatic, this intersection. And so you can do it for Landau. For Landau it's just the opposite. It's the repressor function that seems more dramatic. The activator function is not as dramatic. Right? And for all four, both are good. So all four seem to have both kind of functions. They are very essential. And so we want to look at this intersection that are significant. So this set, this and this set. So four set of, and we got them as training to try to learn something about the gene regulation. So at the end, we produce four sets of training data. Here we have, for example, for SOX2, only the positive set is significant, right? So if we use a fold change of 5 as a cutoff, and then intersect that with the Rick Young binding region, we get sequences for about 22 genes, and so these are the, so for all four we have both the activator and the repressor training set. So we have these training sets that we can try to use to learn the regulatory program. So a very quick summary of the data is that for example, if you look at the set of genes that are in the positive fold change and with both OCT4 and SOX2 binding data, then you get, you know, these kind of genes. Similarly, you can look at negative fold change genes that only have Landau binding signal but not OCT4 and SOX2, and you have this. So there are various types of regulation that you can see from this very simple analysis. So we feel that these gene sets are probably reliable because our fold change is very dramatic. They are 4 or 5 or above. And for the Landau, we have to raise it up to 8 in order to get this statistical significance. So we'll be looking at upstream regions of this in order to find, you know, if there's any overrepresented motifs and so on. I just want to say that some of these genes are actually, just looking at them, we know that they are probably important, right? Things like GATA6, FOX, A2, ABF. So these are genes that are known to be very important in the extra-embryonic development that is turned up very early on in these EBs. a lot of transcription factor in this set, so that is also encouraging. So what we what we want to do, of course, is to use both human, mouse, and as many other vertebrate species as we can get our hands on. And looking at all the data, we decided to just use 6 vertebrate species because the genomes are relatively more complete. But you know, 1 year from now, we'll probably have 9 or 10. Right? So the idea is this. You extract So the Rick Young's experiment was done in human, right? So you take that human reagent and you can use it to blast to the other species in order to extract the orthogonal reagent, and then basically that's a pure exercise of sequence alignment based extraction. And then we use the four mammalian species for motif discovery. We don't include the species that are too far away, but when we got the motif, we always aligned it in the six species in order to see how well they are conserved. Right? So with this data, we extracted these sequences from the multiple vertebrate species. What we want to do is to first identify see if we can recover the motif for the three transcription factor that was studied by this chip experiment, and see if we can also extract any cooperating transcription factors that are not known. And we want to use this motif to define these regulatory modules, that is combinatorial patterns of regulation showing cooperation among these transcription factors. And then after we have learned this, we want to use it to scan a larger genomic region to see if we can find new instances of this. Right? So one of the basic computational model we use to model the combinatorial regulation is based on this type of model that Qing Zhao and I wrote about in 2 years ago. And if you look at a single species, basically it's a hidden Markov model. As you go along in sequence space, a position can either be a background or it can belong to a module. If it belongs to a module, then it can it would generate the module within the module, the position can either come from background or come from one of these motifs. And if it decides to emit from a motif, it will emit the whole motif according to the weight matrix. Right? So this is the single species versions of it. When you have multiple species, then the positions that are aligned together basically are collapsed into a single state, and the transition is from this to that. So the transition probability basically is a mixture of the three different transitions. And then if they are aligned, then the emission model is coupled together. Right? So that's basically the, and then you also have an evolutionary model similar to what Xinhai and Tomba has done in their paper. I won't go into the detail of that. So later on I'll come back to the use of how to use this coupled hidden Markov model in learning the module. But before I do that, just some preliminary survey of the binding site. So if we just use the OCT4, so this is one of the four training set, right? OCT4 and OCT4 binding and positive fold change. Just apply the PVS model, but without the module structure, assuming only that everything is coming from motif. So that's what we call motif mode. So just to discover what motifs are there. Then there are a number of predicted motifs that come out from this, and at least one of them seem to match the OCT4 binding site reasonably well. If we use the SOX tool and positive fold change training set, then we end up predicting a number of motifs that include both the SOX tool and OCT4 motif. So it's sort of interesting that if you use the SOX tool as a starting point, you can get both SOX tool and OCT4. But using OCT4, we're not able to get, statistically speaking, we're not able to get SOX tool. But this is at least indication, again, that SOX tool and OCT4 are working together, which is good. And when we do the same calculation for the other training set, so this is the negative fold change in the OCT4 set and the negative fold change in the Lennard set, we did not get good result. At least we did not get the Lennard motif. Now, Admittedly, the landlord motif that is known in the literature is based on very few sequences, so in itself may not be that reliable. But the fact that we don't get any so reasonably located motif, but rather getting a lot of repeat like thing, degenerate thing, probably means that our motif discovery algorithm is not taking the this kind of pattern into account. So we probably have to refine that process. So I'm not giving up on this two training set, but just so far the result is not so great. But at least we have two training sets that is giving us good result. So let's look at one of the training sets in more detail. Here we have this SOX2 positive full change training set. Now, we can either try to learn all the parameters in that couple hidden Markov model using this training data, or we can try to make use of the lone transcription factor weight matrix in ChanceFact to help us. And we've decided that this is probably wiser. The later option is probably wiser because we don't really have a lot of training data. So to learn all those weight matrices may not be a good idea. And to the extent that we already know that things like SOX2 and OX4 itself are important means that at least for those weight matrices we can use. So we end up looking at about 200 known weight matrices, and we scan these extracted regions in the multiple species, and we try to see which weight matrix has over-represented binding site instances. And using 0.05 as the cutoff, we got about 47 weight matrices that seem to have over-representation. Now, but many of these weight matrices does not have transcription factor that correspond to it that are showing changes in gene expression. Remember, we also have gene expression for all the genes in these two populations. So when we look at these matrices and ask the question, how many of them has transcription factor that are showing interesting fold change, we'll end up only with 5. And these 5 transcription factors are listed here, so they, as expected, include OX4 and SOX2, but it also includes things like ILF and some high mobility group proteins. And there's an interesting FOX motif here. And these are the transcription factors that are showing interesting fold changes. And of these, I think these two are less reliable, because the fold change is only 4 to 5. But these are very high fold changes, so these are probably much more reliable. And for example, if you look at the number of SOX sites, there are 12 in the 22 regions, and what you expect is should be about 5. So it's overrepresented. So we look at these long weight matrices, and basically now in our hidden Markov model, we will assume that these weight matrices are long. We decided not to use the FOX matrix just because the matrix itself is somewhat similar. It has some similarity to the SOX2, so we feel a little bit uncomfortable with that. So we decided to just use this 4. So these are long parameters now. So in the model, the unknown parameters are the transition probability between background and module, and the relative probability of emission for the different types of motifs, and so on. And there's an evolutionary parameter. And basically, we just fit this to the training data in order to learn the remaining parameters. So the parameters that I learned are this listed here. And with that, now you have a complete specification up to the value of the parameter of a generated model for the sequence. So now you can use it to search any sequence for further instances that are likely to come from this regulatory module, right? So previously when we say positive fold change, we mean fold change more than 5. But now we can relax it and say let's look at all the genes with fold change that are only less than bigger than 2, not bigger than 5. And then instead of 22 sequences, we now have 78. So we can now scan this 78 and see. And of course, when we scan, we use the all the species together because the model incorporates cross species comparison in it. And so when you do that, you can, for example, in human, here we have predicted 16 additional modules. So previously we have 7, but now we have 16. So this is excluding the training set. These are the new things. And what you expect from random controls, you expect to get about 4, right? So that means the false positive rate among these predictions should be about 1/4, right? 25%. And then so there's some details on the binding size and so on. But basically, using this approach, we now have actually analyzed some of the other training sets, and we feel that we can make these predictions of modules, and by comparing to applying this exactly the same computations from random promoters and conserved regulatory regions, we feel that the false positive rate is acceptable. It's on the order of 25 to 35%. Now this may seem like a very high false positive rate when we talk to the experimental biologists, but I think for de novo prediction of enhancers, it's not a bad thing because you now have definite predictions that when you do the experiment, you have a decent chance of getting some result. Whereas without this prediction, you have to search over a 40 kb, 50 kb region. And you have to do how many experiments, I don't know. So I think this is still a very valuable kind of prediction. And of course, you also have the corresponding prediction in the other species. So altogether, just from this training set, we have predicted 83 such enhancers. When you look at the detailed mapping of the size in the enhancer for the different transcription factor, you can often see, a high degree of clustering of this size in the predicted enhancer. Of course, that's what you expect. But then, with good conservation. So these are exactly what you are after. So this is a extreme example in about 4 kb upstream from SOX2 transcription start. You have a few hundred base pair that contain many ILF sites. And the blue is the OCT4 site, and so on. So many factors within a very short region with cross species conservation. So this data can deliver this kind of prediction to you. So in conclusion, I think that at this stage, since the technology of microarray expression profiling and chip-chip both has advanced to a relatively mature state, it's now feasible to think about doing this for many at least developmental projects. I think we have a reasonable chance of success. And of course, for ourselves, we have particular interest in embryonic development at a very early stage. The bottleneck for this approach is likely to be, first of all, good antibodies. You need good antibody that can recognize the chromatin bond form of the antibody. And if you just look at the catalog and all the antibody that are used for standard staining, 80% of the time it won't work for chip-chip. So this is a bottleneck now. But there are probably ways to get around it. You can, of course, just like what we did in the Sonic Hedgehog case, you can make your version of the transcription factor to have an epitope that is suitable for this. The tiling array capacity originally was a limitation. So the Limbogen array, the Agilent and Limbogen array that we have tried can tile only a few hundred genes. So that's not clearly not genome scale But I think I won't go into this in too much detail because Sally will probably tell you all about the next generation of optometric array that would deliver whole genome tiling capacity. So I think with that in hand, I think you can have a very high bandwidth experiment. Finally, I think the problem we are having with this project is that the experimental validation is too time consuming, too labor intensive. The postdoc, basically we spend 9 months just to get those field validation results and to make the reporter constructs and so on, and not even trying to validate the sites by mutation analysis. So I think there's an urgent need for a strategy that would accelerate the experimental validation. Otherwise, we'll make hundreds of predictions, and only a few will get validated, and that's not very useful. I'll stop here. And so the applause should be for these guys who are actually doing a lot of the hard work, Hiram and Miguel, the two students and postdoc from Doug Melton's lab, has generated the body of expression profiles, and Hong Yang in my lab has generated the chip data, and the computational analysis are done by Ching, Hong Hai, and Richard in my lab. Thank you.